I think we've seen everything you can imagine. We have a couple of favorite things that people learn wrong to begin with.
This was Jim Hayes, co-founder of the Fiber Optic Association. Jim has over 40 years of training experience, and today we're going to deep dive into how to get started in fiber optics and what are some common problems and challenges one can face. So without further ado, let's start the interview. You are listening to Become Fiber Minded, a podcast about fiber optics. Each week, we are bringing you insightful conversations with industry experts so you can become fiber-minded as well and get the success you deserve. I'm your host, Christian Till, and you can follow me on fiberminded.com. Welcome to Become Fiber-Minded. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Jim, with you being the co-founder of the Fiber Optic Association, and now recently having the 25th anniversary, I was wondering, how did it all started?
Okay, back in the early 1990s, my company, which was called Fotech, which was in the fiber optic test equipment business, had started doing training in the 80s because we were selling equipment to people who had no idea what to do with fiber optics. By the early 90s, one of our partners in doing training was 3M. And Dan Silver from 3M one day said, you know, we should run an industry training conference for fiber optics.
Okay, right on.
And you should do it. You know, the usual, here's a great idea. Why don't you do that for us? So we did. And by the early 90s, we were running giant conferences for training people in fiber optics, where we would take over a hotel or convention center, have hundreds of students, and typically anywhere from 30 to 40 vendors. And we would do this week-long frenzy of training. And in 1995, at the luncheon for the instructors, Dan Silver was there and a whole bunch of other people representing companies in the industry, military organizations, professional trainers, and the like. We got into a discussion of why the industry didn't have a professional society. Mm-hmm. Our example was the IEEE or ISA, the Instrument Society of America, or SCTE, the cable TV people. So Dan turns around and says, well, this sounds like a job for you again, Jim. And so months later, our attorneys for the company founded the Fiber Optic Association, Inc., and we applied for nonprofit status as a what's called a 501c6, which is what professional societies get registered as.
Okay.
And the interesting thing was in 1995, the line out of our application to the IRS said that our charter was to promote professionalism in fiber optics through education, certification, and standards. And 25, 26 years later now, not a thing has changed. That's exactly what we do.
Awesome. Outstanding. So over these years, did you see any change in the skill requirement since you do a lot of training and you have a lot of training experience?
Well, that's an interesting question because the way we developed our certification was guided by the people in the industry who knew what technicians needed. And we had two academics. We had two college professors who had started the earliest college programs on fiber optics. And they provided insight on the educational side. But what we did was we acquired a great idea from the apprenticeship program of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And what they did when they analyzed a job or a task is they developed what were called KSAs. K for knowledge, mm-hmm. S for skills, A for abilities. We adopted the KSAs, and the first thing that we did in developing certifications was to develop KSAs. The answer to your questions is that the KSAs themselves have changed very little in 25 years. The fiber installation process, for example,
right,
is very little different than it was 25 years ago, except for the fact that the instruments and tools that we use have become much more automated.
Okay.
So the additional part of the training, besides the usual hands-on skills now, is how to deal with the automation, because it's all really designed to make the life simpler for the technician. And fortunately, over those 25 years, everybody's become much more tech savvy.
Okay.
But it's still something that really makes a difference. So that if you looked at a training class 20 years ago,
yep,
when somebody got into the testing part of the training, they would teach you how to use meters and sources, and everything was manual. And now it's much more understanding how to set up the instrument for the test and then having it done automatically. One of our instructors is using training people on OTDRs using a system that allows everybody in the class to take their smartphone or tablet and log into the OTDR so they can actually work with it themselves. And the whole class shares an OTDR.
That's good. I mean, nothing beats a good hands-on self-experience clicking your own buttons.
Exactly. One of the things that the FOA tells trainers and schools is that half of the training should be hands-on.
Right.
And the typical training runs anywhere from 3 days to 2 weeks. And in that training, it's pretty much a alternating lab and classroom. And so you would go in and learn about fiber optic cables. Then you would go into the lab and you would actually, we call it dissecting cables.
Yep.
Preparing cables for splicing and termination. So the hands-on part of it is extremely important. And of course, the other thing is that in a few days or a couple of weeks of training, you don't become an expert. But our goal is to produce people who know the process, understand the process, and then they're going to go out into the real world and they're actually going to learn with OJT, on-the-job training.
Okay. And if you see these kind of hands-on require or hands-on testing, what are some of the most common errors and then things you see or come upon?
I think we've seen everything you can imagine. we have a couple of favorite things that people learn wrong to begin with.
Uh-huh.
When we look at the results of our online testing at our online training site, FiberU, and the tests that are used for certification, we find out that about 25% of the people think that when you strip fiber, you strip the cladding.
Mm-hmm.
And for years, that puzzled us. Why anybody would think you could strip the cladding off a solid piece of glass that is what the fiber is. And then we realized, I did a survey on the internet, and I found that everybody in the industry, save the FOA, had a diagram of an optical fiber that showed the core sticking out of the cladding. And it's this thing, you know, it looks like pistons. You know, there's the buffer coating and the cladding and the fiber sticking out. And everybody then thinks that the core and the cladding are separate. And that when you strip fiber, you strip the cladding. And that befuddled us for years until we realized that. And since then, we've convinced a whole bunch of manufacturers to correct their websites.
Oh, I didn't think about this. It's a quite interesting fun fact, I must say.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, there's other things that we find that people get confused by. There's the whole issue of measurements in dB. The human mind does not work in logarithmic functions.
Oh.
And we've had a long fight with people who who can't not fight, but it's an effort to try to get people to understand DB. It's very simple mathematics, but I think as soon as you show a mathematical equation on a web page, that everybody goes to the next page.
Just for the audience, say, could you just briefly explain the difference between DB and DBM?
Most people don't know. You know, we use DB in practically every technical measurement venue. They use it, it goes in the electrical side, it goes in radio frequency, wireless, used in optics, and of course in fiber optics. But what the problem is that people don't understand that it's simply a logarithmic way of expressing something that compresses the scale. Okay? So if you look at optical fiber and fiber optics, The difference between the lowest and the highest levels that we measure is almost 1,000,000 to 1. And it creates way too many zeros and digits and decimal points. So long, long ago, the decibel, which was, by the way, named for Alexander Graham Bell, and originally used in acoustics, The decibel was created as a logarithmic way of compressing 1,000,000 to 1 measurement of power into 60 dB. A factor of 10 in dB is a factor of 10, but 20 dB is a factor of 100, 30 dB is a factor of 1,000 and the like. So we've worked in all sorts of ways to try to explain this and even created a Fiber U mini course just to explain how dB is measured.
Okay.
dB, however, is a relative measurement. It's the difference between two measurements. DBM is an absolute measurement. And DBM refers to dB referred to relative to 1 milliwatt of power. And DBM is the same exact measurement that's used, for example, in light and in RF measurements. The guys who measure RF power measure it in DBM. The next level of confusion came about 17 or 18 years ago when somebody didn't like the fact that loss was negative dB.
Yeah.
And so, in international standards, somebody who obviously didn't have a technical background flipped dB around so that loss is a positive term. And the consequence of that, you know, humans are really bad at understanding the consequences of their action. The really bad part of it is that gain becomes negative.
Right.
So if you look at every OTDR made, as far as I can tell, if you have a gainer, it shows as a negative number. And as somebody who was trained as a scientist many, many years ago, and I actually a physicist and an astronomer by background, and who had to take a year course in metrology, making measurements, that were shared with my fellow astronomers and physicists, to see a system that defines gain as negative dB is grating on your nerves. It violates everything else that's done in the world. I don't know why. But somebody couldn't live with the fact that negative dB is loss and positive dB is gain the way it's supposed to be. The analogy I use, which is what the fiber optic industry should have done back in the early 2000s when they changed this, was counting. Okay?
Yep.
If you look at a accounting information for a company, if they have a profit, it's a positive number. If they have a loss, it's a negative number. But they don't state it as a negative number. They don't like negative numbers either. They put it in parentheses. Why a solution like that wasn't used just befuddles me.
Beats me as well. And the funny thing is, if you look at, for example, EFA and amplification, this one has a gain figure, and this is again a positive number, which says how much the amplification in dB can be expected. So on the one side, you have the dB as a positive, which is corresponding to attenuation or loss. And on the other side, depending on the application as well in fiber optics, it can be also a gainer.
Now, all of this, you know, it's an educational thing. And part of the education isn't to the students who take classes in fiber optics. It's to the writers who work for the companies who create web pages that don't explain things properly.
If you are bothered by the web pages, I mean, I think you are also bothered by the standards itself and the what kind of English is being used and how complicated the standards itself are written for the common technician.
Well, that's a battle I've fought for many years. Back in the, we started our fiber optic test equipment company in 1980. Mm-hmm. In 1980, there were no standards for fiber optics. Nothing. And we started selling fiber optic power meters that people were using to make measurements. And the first thing that we found was that our power meters measured power, which we calibrated according to optical standards.
Okay. Yep.
One of our partners in starting the company was an MIT professor in optics who had access to their lab. So our calibration got transferred out of their labs. But a customer of ours was using a Japanese instrument, and we found there was 3 dB difference.
Wow. 3 dB is half or double.
Half or double, that's right. So we went to the National Bureau of Standards in Boulder, Colorado, and convinced Gordon Day, who was the head of the optics division, that we needed a standard. So for the next 2.5 years, I commuted from Boston to Boulder, working with Gordon Day to create standards for making optical power measurements. Once we had that standard, we're good.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Then we started working with what was then the Electronic Industries Association. It's now the Telecommunications Industry Association. And we were developing standards for the rest of fiber optics. So we developed standards, almost all of the standards, 90% of the standards are testing standards.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. 10% of the standards cover things like the geometry of fibers, you know, the core and cladding size and the coating sizes and things like that. But 90% of the standards are based on testing. They're how much attenuation does a fiber have, at what wavelengths, how much bandwidth does it have, how does it respond to various kinds of stress, like tension or bending, how does it react to immersion and jet fuel. So over the course of the 1980s, we developed all these standards for fiber optics. And most of those standards still exist today. And the standards that have been added since about 1990 have been mostly standards that deal with changes in the fiber optic industry due to the increasing bandwidth of networks.
Okay, yep.
So they deal with things like very high bandwidth fiber. They deal with dispersion, you know, single mode, polarization mode dispersion, chromatic dispersion. They deal with spectral attenuation for wavelength division multiplexing and the like. But the basic standards we developed in the 80s are still around and being revised. In fact, they just changed the standard that I wrote in 1987 or 88 on measuring optical power, mm-hmm, and transferred it to an international standard. And so the standards have developed over the years very effectively, but everyone needs to realize that standards are written by and for manufacturers. Okay? If you go to an organization like ANSI, the American National Standards Institute, or ISO, they'll tell you that standards are designed to facilitate commerce. Okay? If you didn't know how long a meter was, or how long a second was, or how much a kilogram was, you couldn't buy and sell products. Nothing would work.
Yep.
You couldn't make anything work without all of those primary standards. And the same is true in fiber optics. Standards make sure you have connectors that work with other connectors, that fiber works with other fiber, that you can take an outside plant cable and know how hard you can pull it, how much tension you can put on it, based on the way the manufacturer tested it to standards. So standards are very important. But the one thing is the standards are written for manufacturers, and they are written in a language which I describe as standardese, and they are practically impossible for the average person to understand. So the manufacturers are supposed to, according to the TIA, the manufacturers are supposed to interpret those standards for their customers. And that's an important point.
So actually you would recommend if a technician gets a contract to certify or measure a cable plant against a cabling standard like the 14763, to actually go to the manufacturer and let him the manufacturer explains then to the technician what he needs to do, or what would you recommend for this kind of use case?
Well, yeah, the way testing develops, for example, and having been in the test equipment business all of my life, in the electronics and then even physical measurements before fiber, all measurement instruments are based on measuring to some kind of standard. And it's the job of the manufacturer to develop the instrument properly so it makes the measurement properly to the standard. And then their basic job is to teach their customers how to operate the instrument, how to set it up and use it, and how to interpret the data. And that is the most complicated part of it.
Yep.
I've written, I think, about 9 books on fiber optics for techs now. And it's sort of humorous that the book I wrote on testing is almost twice as thick as the basic fiber book.
A lot of stuff gets into that. I mean, so what's things you have to consider and eventualities?
Well, it's very complicated. The job of the manufacturers is to try to simplify the process so that the average technician can understand it. I joke about the fact that when I started in fiber optics, the installation work was being done by PhDs from Bell Labs. And today, the group of people that we train who are installing fiber optics are non-technical people 90% of the time.
But they still get the job done. This brings me to my follow-up question. If the non-technical people get trained by you to do the basic fiber installation, stripping, etc., how can they progress? How can they move forward and get to the next level of their career?
The majority of people involved in any kind of trade, and I don't care if it's carpentry or installing fiber optics, they learn by on-the-job training.
Right.
And the question is, what provision is there for them to do OJT? Yeah, OJT is on-the-job training, and on-the-job training occurs 90% on the part of the person who wants to get trained themselves, and 10% because they usually have a supervisor who shows them how to do it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully that supervisor knows how to do it right. That's an important point, actually,
yes.
Because we find that, you know, my joke about stripping the cladding belief that so many techs have, they learn it from their bosses who learned it many years ago wrong. The 90% part, people learn by practice, and today they learn it online. So what the FOA has done is create an environment where people can learn. When the FOA started, as I said, our idea was to promote professionalism through education, certification, and standards. The educational part of it started off being in-classroom training. Okay?
Yep, makes sense.
About the same time, about 1997, we became involved with online training.
Okay.
Practically nobody was doing it, but it turned out that my company, Fotech, had a summer intern who was a teacher in the Boston school system who had started creating training programs online for teachers.
Right.
And he had a method of doing this with hypertext, markup language, you know, HTML pages. And the secret was to first have online content.
Right.
So what we did was we took at Fotech at that point, we took the books that we had already been creating and the training material. We had it all already online. We had one of the first 30,000 web pages in 1995. If you think about that, there are probably 30 billion web pages now.
Yep.
And we had this material online, and the HTML code was relatively easy to write to lead you through this material and let you teach yourself. People really don't get taught, they learn, which is what you learn from the educational experts. So in 1997, we started FiberU Online.
Okay.
After we sold Fotech in 2000, FiberU was abandoned. And eventually, a few years later, the FOA picked up the trademark, which had been lapsed, and recreated FiberU Online. We started with about 10 or 15 pages of technical information. The FOA now has almost 1,000 pages of technical content. We have more technical content on fiber optics on the internet than anybody else in the world. And then with FiberU, what we do is we create online courses that use that content, guide you through reading that content, watching our videos. We have 100 videos, including 61 lectures on YouTube on fiber optics and about 50 hands-on demonstrations. And so we lead you through reading pages, watching videos. We give you quizzes to test how you learn, and then eventually give you the opportunity to get a certificate of completion for the course. We have almost 30 courses online now, some of which will take you 30 or 40 hours to get through, some of which you can do in an hour. But FiberU, FiberU.org, FiberU.org has become a place that about 20,000 people a month take courses on fiber optics.
And then just to confirm, everything of what you mentioned with the lecturers, with FiberU, everything is free, right?
Everything is free. When the FOA was started, we decided that we would be a nonprofit. We may have been the first professional society created in the internet age. And the reason is that the internet existed, and we realized that by working on the internet, as opposed to doing things in person, building a brick and mortar, you know, presence, having real offices and the like, that we could tap the expertise of people around the world. When we were doing FiberU, the FiberU that we founded the FOA at had visitors from South America, Central America, Europe, Australia and New Zealand, and the Far East.
across the world?
South Africa.
No.
And we recruited people like that to be the experts that we use to develop our programs. So, for example, the person behind the FOA's outside plant construction program is a guy named Joe Botha in South Africa. We have experts on working in the Arctic. Not many people know how to work fiber optics in the Arctic, but we have a guy in Copenhagen and a guy in Toronto who work above the Arctic Circle all the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have people who work in the desert in Africa. We have people who, of course, all over the United States. But by being a virtual organization, not only can we tap the expertise of these people around the world, but it's very inexpensive. Okay, we're not paying a mortgage, we're not paying rent, we don't spend time traveling per se to meet. We just all get together and we can work on things over the internet. By doing that from ground zero, we knew our overhead would be low. And we decided that what we would do is we would keep all the costs as low as possible. And the way we do online training, for example, at FOA, is very inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
All the courses are free. You can take them and enjoy them all on your own. It's your own time schedule. And if you want a certificate of completion, you pay a nominal sum, usually $10 or $20, to get a certificate for a course. And that pays for the testing service that we use. The rest of the FOA's expenses are paid by certification fees, because we have certified 83,000 plus technicians who have over 110,000 certifications.
Whew, that's a lot.
So it's a lot.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. That's part of the reason we're so well known. We have a lot of acolytes out there. And we publish textbooks for people who like textbooks. And we publish our own books. So they're self-published and the income from that pays the rest of the bills. So we can afford to give people a free course that others are trying to tell you should pay them, you know, hundreds of dollars for. But online training is straightforward. It's easy. People learn a lot. We find people really love FiberU and they really use it. And that's sort of the goal of the FOA. You know, it's promoting education.
Outstanding.
And FiberU makes the perfect basis for OJT. So if you have someone who wants to learn on the job and they want to learn how to do testing, they want to learn how to do splicing, they want to learn about the last course I just put up a couple of days ago, strangely enough, should have been one of the first. It's on fiber optic color codes. Yeah, why didn't we put that course up, you know, years ago? But what happens is somebody asks us a question and we turn that into a course.
Yeah.
So now there's a new course on color codes.
That's nice. So and with the on-the-job training, they can come to you and your instructors will go out with them into the field, or how does it work?
No, we expect people, because we have hundreds of schools around the world.
Yep.
After the pandemic, they're starting to get back to offering classes. During the pandemic, probably 75% of all of the training was online.
Mm.
We've shown our schools how to do what's called blended learning.
Yep.
Where the classroom part of the course is done online at FiberU. And then all they need to do is to bring people in for the hands-on. And easier with a small class doing hands-on to get physical separation and to run everything safely. But if you're doing OJT, the assumption is that you have a supervisor who is leading you to jobs And we want to make sure that the supervisors know about FiberU as well as the people, so that they understand that there is a place to go for almost any subject they can imagine and they can learn about.
And let's say the technician doesn't have this supervisor who is that knowledgeable, or he's seeing things which are not right. Can they come to you to maybe find a mentor or to get some other insights?
They use us as mentors. Right. Yes.
Perfect.
When we need to, we'll track down people who can help them. We feel questions all the time from people who want to get some advice, information, or just to clarify some crazy thing going on that they see.
Yep.
And they see some pretty crazy things.
I can imagine. So seeing now the move to blended learning with FiberU and all the online courses, Jim, where do you see FiberU going maybe in the next 3 to 5 years? Are we then having the augmented reality, virtual reality experience as well with FiberU?
Well, what we're finding is as our schools come back, they use FiberU more than they did before because they've become used to it. And the goal for people who are coming to a class in person is to teach as efficiently as possible. And so what we have schools now encouraging people to do is to go take a basic fiber optic course at FiberU and get their certificate of completion and bring that to class.
Okay.
That means that instead of spending half of the time in the class on the classroom and half on hands-on, they can spend two-thirds or more of the time on hands-on, which means that often that classes can be shorter, which everybody wants, because a day spent in class is a day not being spent on the job.
Right.
And when it comes to OJT, that's very important.
What's your experience with the over 110,000 certifications you have handed out? And how is the acceptance overall from the industry? So can I put it on my resume and I get a job at Horizon something if I have a certificate of completion? Or what's the level of what can I expect with this kind of certificate?
The FOA is the international organization that's recognized. I've traveled the world myself. I spent a lot of time talking with everybody from technicians through companies, through telcos or service providers, right on up to telecom ministers. And the FOA is the certification that most recognize. We get about a dozen calls a week from somebody who is involved in a project that says they have to be FOA certified. And they know who we are, but they've never gone through the certification. And of course, a lot of these people have been in the business for 20 years. And that brings up another part of the program. We don't require everybody to take a course, become certified. Typical with the international standards for certification, anybody who meets the standards for experience can apply to stand for the exam. So we have a, what we call work to cert program.
Okay, perfect.
And that represents more than 15% of all of our certifications. 1/5.
Okay.
About 15% of our certifications are people who come to us directly. They have experience, and we have a path to get them certified. So they submit a resume, we approve their resume, they go back to FiberU, because I can guarantee you there aren't many techs in the field who worked for 20 years who could pass the CFOT certification exam without a little studying. So they have a place to study. It's called FiberU. So they go to FiberU, they take the basic course,
yep,
which is the basis for the CFOT certification, bring us their certificate of completion, and then they can stand for the exam. And we're also pioneers on doing exams online. We've been doing our exams online for more than 15 years.
Do the certifications expire, or do I need to renew them, or what's the policy for this?
Well, we follow the international standards. It's an ISO 17024 for certifying bodies, and we have an expiration period of 3 years.
Okay.
So after 3 years, you have to do a renewal, and that usually involves also a short online course. It's a refresher course.
Okay, refresher course, and then it's the same exam 3 years ago, which you need to pass again.
It's a different exam.
Okay.
It's not the basic exam. It's a refresher exam, and half of it is on the basics that you would have learned as part of the original certification, and half of it is an online course on new technology.
All right, makes sense.
So we want to refresh people on the basic knowledge and bring them up to date. And we do that with a 50-50 online course that takes about 3 or 4 hours.
Okay, sounds doable.
Nobody complains. And it's all interesting. You know, this is the people in fiber optics, I have to say, are generally speaking the people who are the most interested in learning. They want to learn new things. They want to enhance their skills. They really want to
progress.
Be the best they can be.
Yep. Yeah, I definitely see this as well across my travels and my discussions I have. So it's really interesting, and kudos to you, Jim, for doing this, for founding the FOA, and with the FiberU, what you have done. Outstanding work. Thank you for doing this. Much appreciated.
Oh, thank you. That's nice to hear. I want to say, though, that I am the face of the FOA and the voice, because I often walk into trade shows and people will turn around because they've watched our YouTube video lectures and they recognize my voice. But the FOA is a very large group of people. We have our board of directors and our advisors all around the country. We have people who are involved with big companies. One of our directors works for Corning. Another works training people in a professional society of traffic engineers. Another one has jokingly says he's trained everybody in Canada. Another one's trained everybody in South Africa. Another one is in Copenhagen. And this guy, we never know where he's going to show up. He sends us pictures of glaciers in Greenland. Where he's installing optical power ground. So, you know, the FOA is a very, very large group of people. Our whole design program is really based on a lot of work done by one of our schools in Malaysia and Singapore. We have all of these people who contribute. And one of the things which we always do is we tell people, please contribute. We have people who are sending us their stories or asking us their questions. That's how we find out what people are interested in and what they want to know.
Yep, makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. Custom tailored to the audience. That's the right way forward. Thank you so much for your time. Once again, Jim, where can people find more about FOA?
FOA.org or FiberU.org. And a final sort of humorous kind of thing. When you have 1,000 pages of technical information online that 500,000 people download about 4 million pages a year from, you find out that when you do an online search, you end up at the FOA. And that's great for everybody else, but it drives me crazy because when I try to research things on fiber optics, all I do is end up at my own website.
I'm pretty sure you can add the incisive search terms to not show FOA.org inside your Google search. So thank you for joining.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Become Fiber Minded. If you enjoyed this episode, I would appreciate it if you could do me a quick favor and rate and review the podcast. This shows the platform that I'm doing something right and that people like the content. And if you learn something new, tell a friend or colleague about the podcast so I can help more people. Be sure to go to fiberminded.com/episode2. Once again, fiberminded.com/episode2 to see the show notes with the links mentioned in this episode. And until next time, keep connecting the world with fiber.